our call to order. Do we need, you've taken note of who's here, right? We don't yet have a quorum, but we, most, our items are mostly information items. We'll skip over approval of our minutes until we have a quorum, if we do. Item three is key focus areas for JPC member agencies. What we did is put on the agenda an opportunity for each executive director to give an update of their key focus areas, but my understanding is that the desire is to have this at the next meeting because Steve is not here and Jack's not here, although their capable alternates are here. And you're just potted plants, right. But my understanding from all of you is that your preference is to have this be at the next meeting?
We have a full agenda.
Yes, we do. So we have time that we want to come back to this. We can. So, okay. Moving on to item four, introduction of the JPC Organizational Planning Consultant. We'll have Allison Brooks do that.
Thank you, Chairman Gioia. I'm delighted to introduce Gina Bartlett, who is going to provide a quick introduction of herself and a quick overview of the process moving forward for JPC organizational planning. Gina is with the Consensus Building Institute, and we're excited to have her, so I'll hand it over to you.
Good morning. My name is Gina Bartlett, and I'm pleased to be here. And I thought I'd just give you a couple slides. I work with the Consensus Building Institute, and we work on a variety of areas internationally. Most relevant to all of you is organizational governance and strategy. And we also do a lot of work on energy, environment, land use, and others, as you can see. As far as my qualifications to do the organizational planning, I'm a highly skilled facilitator. I do a lot of work with organizations both throughout California on collaborative governance, and by that I mean different agencies and organizations coming together, figuring out how to define a structure that's efficient and effective for them to work together. I have worked with BCDC pretty extensively. I did their strategic plan with them last year in 2013, and then I've done a variety of projects with them over the last 10 or 12 years and involving ABAG staff as well. I think the thing that I'm really interested about this project is that you have four distinct agencies with their own culture, distinctive staff, and that the JPC is an opportunity to provide coordination across that. I think given the issues facing the Bay Area, it's more pertinent and critical than ever, but coordinating and regionalism is messy in implementation. So I think it's going to be a very interesting process to kind of unbundle that and figure out the best way to make that come together. We are going to do this work over the course of the next 6 months, and the first phase is that I'm interviewing the executive directors, and I'm holding some staff brown bags and talking with a variety of folks to get their opinion on the JPC. And then in the November-December timeframe, we will be coming back to the JPC in November to have a workshop with all of you to get your insights and direction on what you would like to see the JPC be into the future. And then the core element of this is that I will be meeting with the executive directors and the JPC director in a series of sessions to really define the scope and purpose and organizational plan for the JPC following the direction that you provided in November. And then in the January-February timeframe, we will be vetting that with bringing it back to you once again, the proposed approach, as well as vetting that with some of the key staff. The goal is to bring back I think it'll be your March meeting, probably depending on your sequence of meetings, a proposed plan. So that's really it. If you have any insights or questions right now, that would be great to hear. And here's my contact information. And I look forward to getting to know you all better and working together. Thank you.
So are there any questions or comments? Julie.
Yeah, it sounds like you're just the right person for this job.
I hope. Thank you.
I am wondering, as you go back to that slide on your schedule, I'm wondering if when you do, that one, in the September-October timeframe, you're mm-hmm. looking at doing interviews with the executive director, some staff meetings, and a survey. Who's that survey going to go to?
Well, the plan was for the survey to go to the staff, but if you have some suggestions for who that should go to, we'd love to hear it.
I think it could help to go all the way around the table. We may all have somewhat different visions of what this could be, and it might give you some insight even before we have sort of our round table. And part of the problem, as you see, is getting a quorum sometimes. And so, you know, when we're at a meeting, if only half of us are here, you're not getting full feedback.
That would be wonderful. So unless there's any reason we can't do that with the Brown Act, I think that would be great.
Yeah. I mean, if we're just responding directly back to you with ideas, it doesn't seem like, as long as we're not having a discussion online, we should be fine.
Great. Okay, you're in. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Uh-huh. All right, moving on to really our main item today, overview of California Strategic Growth Council and Affordable Housing and SCS Program Guidelines. Before I introduce the Executive Director, Mike McCoy, I think maybe what's relevant is I'll give a brief update about our California Air Resources Board meeting yesterday where we approved the interim guidelines, the SB 535 guidelines. So, because it's relevant, I know, to what, Mike, you're going to talk about. And I appreciate there were folks here from regional agencies at ARB. So you all know the interim guidelines are guidelines that are issued to both state and regional agencies about how to meet the requirements of SB 535, which is that 10% of cap and trade revenues need to be spent in disadvantaged communities and 25% need to be spent to benefit disadvantaged communities. So there were two issues. Cal EPA, and we've had a lot of discussion here, issues the maps that define the disadvantaged communities. ARB doesn't issue those. That's Cal EPA. But this Air Resources Board developed the guidelines of what it means to benefit those communities for the additional 15%, for the 25% in each of the categories, in Strategic Growth Council dollars, in for the affordable housing, SCS, in low-carbon transportation, low-carbon transit, all the different categories. And these interim guidelines are just that. They are interim, and they're meant to be reviewed and finalized and made permanent next year. And I actually suggested some changes off the staff a proposal based on a lot of the comments, and I think moved us in a good direction along the lines of what we've talked about. So just to be clear, one of the issues I know MPC raised a lot was the issue of looking at, you know, corridors, transportation corridors. And so the guidelines say that when you look at benefiting a disadvantaged communities, that the draft was, you know, in a disadvantaged community and the zip code in which it was located or half a mile from the disadvantaged community. And one of the things we talked about was that, well, routes will start or end in a disadvantaged community but take people to their place of work, take them elsewhere, and that corridor is really important. So I think we clarified that, which is the intention that a route along a corridor that goes outside of the zip code is also covered because it's going to the destination, which is in a disadvantaged community. That's an example. We talked also a bit about there was discussion about making sure that the anti-displacement policies, which are in there, dealing with affordable housing, are general and apply elsewhere, and those are in there as well. So the bottom line is those interim guidelines will get implemented because my understanding is some state agencies are going to start getting money out the door, and it'd be interesting to hear, you know, from your standpoint, Mike, how you think that all applies to, I think we're all interested in hearing how the SCS and affordable housing money gets out into the communities and how it's spent and what your thinking is, what the Strategic Growth Council's thinking about doing, and then how maybe some of these guidelines would be applied as well. So, maybe you can come over here. And again, this is just for the one category, right, of cap and trade dollars that is identified through the Strategic Growth Council, because there's a lot of other dollars through other categories.
Thank you, John. And thanks for having me here today, Arun. And thanks for Jake McKenzie to you for showing up. I'm always honored to be in his presence.
Well, I'm going to stand a bit
Let's not talk about that. I like getting out of Sacramento. I learn something every time I do. I think that regional and local government is the innovation hub of government, and it stokes our imaginations to see what you're doing and to go back to Sacramento and see how that can be consistent with state policy and law and how we can all work together. We're really pleased to be part of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund through the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program. When I came to work for the council 2 years ago, I was told to not get my hopes up about this as the next source of funding. We probably would not get it. In fact, you really shouldn't spend too much time trying. Well, I spent a lot of time trying, and so did you. And I think that the state listened to that, the legislature listened to that, and we ended up with a very sizable portion of the entire program on a continuing appropriation, which is really rare for the state and gives us a real sense of what we have to work with, perhaps over the next decade or decade and a half, in which time we could build an awful lot of good projects. So I'll start out with the overview of the investment fund, just to see where we fit. The fund was $832 million, sorry, and it was divided according to these divisions, with $130 million going into the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program. Sorry. The change in weather from Sacramento to here, I think, has affected my throat. Each one of these will be guided by the ARB guidelines, which John mentioned earlier, so the entire program falls under those guidelines, including the Affordable Housing Sustainable Community Program. We are bounded by a lot of policy and law in terms of how this money can be spent. The first is, sorry, go back to that, that this is bounded by SB 535, and so all of the programs must be consistent with that legislative mandate. But then there are further regulations that bind us in terms of putting parameters around what we can and can't do with these funds. And there are public processes. 1018 is a little known piece of legislation that's going to cost us a lot of time, but be worth it for the taxpayer in the end. Very strict accounting guidelines, both what we achieve and what we spent and how we spent it, and really a legislative mandate to have a clear, open, transparent project with all the details out there for everyone to see. And then finally, 862, creating the affordable housing program, itself contained a number of pieces of advice from the legislature about the appropriation. Among those were that 50% of these funds would go to affordable housing. And that made it the Affordable Housing-Sustainable Communities Program. So it's really both. We're going to try and step in where California's housing financing has fallen short and see if we can't do both with these funds. I think we can. It's going to be a hunt because then we're further circumscribed by the rules that John and his colleagues passed yesterday that define a disadvantaged community. And to make it a little more narrow, since 10% and 25% are unlikely to be found from some of these programs, for example, fixing the fuel mixture in a diesel truck probably helps disadvantaged communities, but the burden of proof there is going to be probably more than we could bear if we were in a court case. So playing it safe, this program, the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities Program, will do 50% of its work in disadvantaged communities.
Or to benefit
disadvantaged communities. I will note, John, that we talked to Chair Nichols about this just the day before the meeting. The particular way that benefit is defined for our tranche of funds, it might as well be in, because it's within a half mile, and that has to do, of course, with transit stops. So we really are going to be in disadvantaged communities or very near them. There still remains to be defined where disadvantaged communities are. What they are, what creates a benefit to them has been decided, but where they are has not. That decision will be made by Secretary Rodriguez by the end of this month. And he will use, is committed to using, the EnviroScreen tool, which you've all seen. And the only remaining question is this going to be the top 10%, or as I like to call it, the bottom 10%, the bottom 20%, or the bottom 25%? And that'll make a difference, especially here in the Bay Area, where the definitions of disadvantaged communities don't fit quite as well as they do in other parts of the state.
Can I just clarify what you said? So of the category, 50% of it will be statutorily has to be used for affordable housing, and then the other 50 for the other SCS-related activities. Just to be, I don't make sure, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, and then there's the 50% disadvantaged community rule. So you can start seeing that our world is going to become a world of working with you to find best fits for the governance that is ahead of us. The way this works in a bureaucratic sense is that right at the top, we've got GHG reductions. That's what this is about. We all know that. This is a mitigation fund, and it's to mitigate the cap and trade program. And so really at the top of the list must be GHG reductions. You'll hear that throughout the development of guidelines over the coming months. Certainly the law allows and encourages us to achieve co-benefits in terms of public health, open space, natural resources, parks, all sorts of good things that we could do in addition to reduce greenhouse gases. But that's what it is. It's in addition to. And then in addition to those things, we wish to support disadvantaged communities as much as possible. So that then comes down to the Strategic Growth Council, who has integrated oversight over the agencies that will be involved in shaping the program. And you know, we're a council of seven agencies, starting with the Department of Ag, the Business Consumer Services and Housing, Cal EPA, Health and Human Services, the Natural Resources Agency, OPR, and the Cal State Transportation Agency, and one public member, Bob Fisher, a Bay Area resident. And the idea of forming the council was that in past times, each one of these agencies would have had a different take on this program. And if Alex went up and asked Brian Kelly, what's this program supposed to be? She'd get an answer, and she'd come back here and say, hey, I got the answer. And then John would go up a couple of weeks later and talk to Cal EPA, and they'd give him an answer, and he'd come back and said, I got the answer, and they'd compare, and it wouldn't be the same answer. So the council is an innovative attempt to unify government's response to policy, and it's an experiment. It's a work in progress, and we're going to ask your patience as we work through this, but it's exciting, it's innovative, and we hope it's the future of California government. Foremost among the departments we will use, the agencies and department we will use in this program, are the Resources Agency and the Department of Housing and Community Development. The Transportation Agency is also playing a significant role, as is Cal EPA. Those are really our big four. I know who your big four are, but these are our big four in making decisions about the program. There is an AgLand tranche of funds built into this program. This was a last-minute negotiation with the legislature, I think, by interests that contend, and I think rightly so, that if we don't secure the perimeter, we don't we can't affect infill as much as we might if there is some perimeter program as well that protects open space. And then the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities Program. In that program, again, top of the list, demonstrate GHG reductions. Consistent with the state planning priorities, which are a little known piece of California law, but they do enunciate that we are committed in California to infill first. That's actually a priority in state law regarding state support for local programs and for state investment of its own infrastructure funds. Number two is the economy, the environment, natural lands, and working lands. We vow to protect those in state law. And then finally, where greenfield development must occur for reasons of all sorts, like we run out of space in an infill program in a city or whatever it is, the law asks that it be as efficient as possible and that it have the lowest possible establishment and ongoing costs to the taxpayer. We consider these very important, and I'll talk more about them a little bit later in regards to our infrastructure review program, but they do guide us in what we think are the most important elements. We firmly believe that the work you've done is worthy of support, and so implementing regional sustainable community strategies is right up there with the state's two top goals and your top goal, and we want to work together achieving those things. And then, as I said, 50% invested in disadvantaged communities and 50% for affordable housing. The eligible uses, this is just a part of the eligible uses. In a very unusual move, the Department of Finance agreed to have a flexible program. Can you imagine? And so there is discretion. We don't know how much of what we will fund. And it's really going to have a lot to do with where is the biggest bang for the buck, what helps you the most, what helps us the most in achieving those goals right here.
Can you put the last slide back up? So just to note, I mean, I know you identify transit here, but there is also a separate category of low-carbon transit money.
Yes.
How do you anticipate coordinating any decisions here with the larger pot of, because this is not a lot of money, this category, the larger pot of transit-specific money?
Yeah. We fully intend for these to be supportive relationships. Kate White is on the steering committee for this program, and she's on the steering committee for the Transit Capital and Transit Operations Program. So she's our link. We're going to try and merge these things wherever we can. This year it's going to be rough, I'll tell you that, because we're having to sprint out of the box and get things done. Our guidelines aren't being developed at the same time or by the same people, and we're going to have to start merging these criteria and these programs as time goes on, but that is the goal for sure. And the eligible uses go on to, as I said, a long list. It's going to be mix and match. We even were told that affordable housing could mean if we bring in the last mile of a bike way or a pedestrian way that is required as a condition of development for a housing project, we've got a housing project. So we want to work with you very closely to find your last mile projects, your stormwater infrastructure that couldn't be paid for by the developer or the public jurisdiction. Let us step in and do it. We really want to be that gap filler as much as we possibly can. It's not a big sum of money. So the question is, what can we do? How can we do the most good with this money? And then we do have loans as well as grants, so that'll be mainly on that'll be on the housing side of the activity. Again, I say this so many times, people are going to get tired of hearing it, but I really want to be immensely clear that this is the driver. This is what we will be held accountable for at the end of the day, and so we can do that. But and many people have asked, well, can we do that if we also can we count really having a zero net energy community? Can our housing be zero, and can we count that? And the answer is not directly, because that's in other programs in law, and it's an ancillary benefit in this program. We will certainly consider it as a bonus for funding in this program, but it is not part of this program. Co-benefits, the list is really long. These are the ones that were in statute. We believe there are others, and we will enunciate those in our proposed draft guidelines.
One of the questions that came up at Air Resources Board yesterday was, to the extent that ARB has its guidelines that are oriented toward other agencies like Strategic Growth Council, that also indicate that programs which have the maximum amount of co-benefits need to be prioritized in the scoring system. How would you anticipate the Strategic Growth Council is going to incorporate that in its funding guidelines?
Yeah, we do have, and here's the sad story about today. If we had had this next Friday, I'd have the guidelines in my hand, and we could talk about that. Staff are going to finish those tomorrow. Yes, I know it's Saturday. They're going to finish them tomorrow. They're going to have them on my desk Sunday. I will have a last review Sunday, and we will publish these on Monday, probably after I freak out a little bit and a few things get changed Monday morning. But Monday these will be published, and we'll have some very clear answers to that question.
So you also will be ensuring that those projects that have more co-benefits are prioritized or have higher scores?
Yes.
Than those that have less co-benefits.
Yes, I can tell you that for sure. And when you see the criteria for judging programs, and I'll say this, if it's not immensely clear, we're going to have four public workshops, and we certainly want your active participation in commenting on these guidelines. If these goals are not clear to you, that we've addressed them appropriately or vigorously enough, I want to know it. There's a few more. So really, there are types. We're going to have to normalize this a little bit, because there's types of funding that aren't going to improve air quality, or there's types of funding that won't support economic growth. So there will be a mathematical normalization of types, appropriate co-benefits for each of the types of eligible uses that might come forward. And ARB already did. I guess I could strike that one off now. It will be ARB has provided further guidance on measures for co-benefits. And ARB will continue to be updating their guidance on benefits and co-benefits and GHG calculations as time goes on. Right now we're being allowed to take the lead on that as they build the staff capacity to deal with it. I'll tell you this. I'm a former travel modeler, a reforming travel modeler from the University of California at Davis, and so I do have a good understanding of what can get us benefits and what can't, and so hopefully I won't stray too far from what the ARB eventually announces as their goals. Our estimated timeline, we held public workshops. I know we had one right here in this room. It was very well attended, and more than 100 people here. And we got tremendous feedback that's really helped guide our development. The soft check here is that, as I said, it's Monday, so we're almost there. I felt I had a right to kind of check that off. We'll have four public workshops in October, and they will be late October because they will be 30 days after the publication of these guidelines. That's a legal requirement of the guidelines. So we're looking at the 23rd of October at the earliest. And we probably will hold one on the 23rd of October somewhere, because we're anxious to then move on to releasing the final guidelines in November ahead of the December meeting of the Strategic Growth Council, where the guidelines will be proposed for council approval. In January, we hope to have the notice of funds available posted for you. Applications will be due in April. and notices of awards will take place in June. So it's an aggressive timeline. I came from 34 years in academia. This would not have been seen as an aggressive timeline there. Now that I've learned how government really operates, what the intricacies are, how many people need to look at things, I understand this. This is an aggressive timeline. But we have every intention of meeting it. I'm going to end there because there's another thing I want to get to, and that is great to talk about climate change and reducing GHGs, but there's also a very important program we're working on at the SGC on infrastructure and adaptation of infrastructure expenditures to that, what we see as our future. But I'm going to leave that for a moment. If we have time, we'll go back to it, but I know you probably have a lot of questions about the primary program.
So I know I'll start with the question I think that's on a lot of our minds, which is how are you anticipating the funding flowing out to the work in the regions? So it, here in the case of the Plan Bay Area, which is our SCS here in the Bay Area, how do you anticipate money going directly to metropolitan planning organizations, to what types of agencies, who's eligible? Can you talk more about that?
Glad to. It is a work in progress, as Alex knows. We met just yesterday again, third meeting on the subject, with representatives of what I call the Big Five. I know you all think about the Big Four, but the San Joaquin Valley would be the third largest MPO if it were a single MPO, so that's my fifth. I've got the Big Five, and the San Joaquin Valley was represented by a single representative at this meeting. We're moving towards a program that envisions applicants being at the local level and the list of eligible applicants requiring a public jurisdiction. This is a long-standing requirement of housing and community development housing programs to have a public agency, in the words of Claudia Capio, on the hook to ensure that expenditures take place in an appropriate manner and that there is long-term liability for the capital that is put out there. Well, here's the way it might look. We're going to do a two-step process. We know that. We don't want a lot of people wasting their time on voluminous proposals. These are going to be big projects, right? So we're envisioning over $10 million from this fund on single projects. So there aren't going to be a lot. Over time, there'll be a lot, but there won't be a lot in any given year. And so we don't want a lot of people wasting their time on voluminous proposals. I have one on my desk right now from the 1C program that's almost 2,000 pages. We're not going to ask somebody to do that if they don't stand an awfully good chance of being competitive. So we will have an early concept submittal round, and in that round, the SGC will go through those applications to get rid of things that don't meet basic fundamental eligibility requirements. You might think of it as a ministerial review of things that are not consistent with statute. We'll then share those with the MPOs for technical review of consistency and support for your SCS. Are these projects, is this project something that is going to move you down the road towards your goals of reducing GHGs in your region? That will lead us to jointly assemble a list of eligible applicants for round two, which will be the 2,000-page voluminous proposal. We don't expect too many of that ilk because we will probably have a large fund and a medium-sized fund tranche with smaller projects being in the lesser tranche. But we will have some really big proposals. And at that point, we are going to concurrently review those. The MPOs will take state guidelines and use their technical staff, their knowledge of the region, their understanding of that program, their understanding of the state's goals, and score these projects. At the same time, four of my seven agencies will be doing the same thing. And so we're going to do this concurrently, and this is going to be a real educational program. I'm not contending that we ought to do this for the rest of eternity, but in the early going here, getting to know each other, getting to understand each other, learning to work together and to trust one another is going to be a tremendous asset. Trust me on that. Going down the road a few years from now, it's going to allow for a great deal more independence for everyone, and I think it's going to be, we're off to a good start. So we'll have a conversation about those. We'll come back together and say, my goodness, this one's in my bottom 25% and your top 25%. What happened here? And that's where the learning is going to occur. And one party or another may rescore or may not based on what they've learned at that point, but we will have that exchange. The projects that are at the top of your list will go to your boards.
So when you say agencies, are you saying MTC, a county, a city, all of them eligible? Is there a view about where you would prefer projects coming from or which would be the projects with the greatest chance for success?
Well, this is, first of all, at this point, and I hope this isn't new news to anyone, but the MPOs themselves will not be eligible recipients of funds. The reason being, you're going to have a very heavy role in reviewing projects, and so we can't have you in both roles. But certainly we expect you will be coaching local projects that are of the most help to your goals. That's really what it's about.
So let me make sure I'm clear. When you say MPO, you're talking both MTC and ABAG in this case because they jointly did the SCS, or just ABAG not being eligible? So maybe if you can just, so we know. Yeah. Who's that? Who would not be eligible? ABAG not. What about MTC?
Both not.
Both not. So Air District would be eligible. BCDC would be eligible. Cities and counties would be eligible.
Yeah.
Special districts. So
special districts.
Special districts, counties, cities, Air Board, Regional Water Quality Control Board, potentially BCDC, but not ABAG and MTC.
Yeah.
Okay.
I still don't have complete clarity on the status of the Air Boards and the Water Quality Control Boards. We're waiting for a legal opinion on that.
Because Air Districts and BCDC are not metropolitan planning organizations, right? They're at least
right,
they're regulatory.
Right. They're regulatory.
They have a planning function too.
Right.
How are you going to anticipate? And then we'll go around with questions. I know a lot of folks may have questions here. How are you going to look at regional equity around the state as you disperse funding to ensure that, you know, each region of the state within the guidelines is getting sort of some equitable proportion of money.
Right. This is one of the most difficult questions. And if we distributed this by population, for example, we should send a check for $3.84 to every Californian, because that's what it comes out to. But that's not what we're going to do. We won't get very much traction that way. Alternately, we could say that there are we'll sum that up and say, given your population, that comes to $8 million in the Bay Area, or $13 million. I can't remember what it was. And that was another proposal. There are proponents for those kinds of decision processes, and then there are proponents for a completely free, open, competitive process. This is not fully resolved. We will we may or may not on Monday address this in the guidelines. We will address it prior to the council's October 6th meeting. So we have a second opportunity. The law does not require us to give 30 days for these guidelines for a council meeting. So we may have to delay that announcement until 10 days prior to the council meeting.
And you did say that the MPOs are going to be involved in evaluations. You made some reference to that. Can you explain that further? You said they're not eligible because they're going to be involved.
Heavily involved.
How does that work? With the Strategic Goal Council?
Yes. From the very get-go. We haven't completely agreed on this, but the proposal is that we will be equal partners, you and me, the MTC and the Strategic Growth Council, Ezra and me. We will be equal partners, and we will each assign staff to read these proposals. And those staff will then be required to meet together and talk about their similarities and differences so that we can try and move towards common ground. If we don't move towards common ground, you're still entitled to your opinion, to take what you want to your board, to advance it for state consideration. But we're going to at least try and learn to value the way each other look at projects. And so you will be heavily, heavily involved in this process, still retaining your autonomy at the end of the day. But we will have a good chance to understand one another.
Okay. So why don't we go around, and I'm sure questions. Jim, longtime MTC commissioner. Longest serving MTC commissioner, I'm sure.
First, thank you for being here. You know, in your earlier comments, I was very encouraged, but the longer you spoke, the more discouraged I got. And so,
the what? It went in the ditch.
Yeah, you drove off the road. The MPOs throughout the state, you know, we were asked to implement SB 375, and, you know, we developed our, you know, Bay Plan area, and just about everybody in this room has a lot of scars through that process. And, you know, we identified and came up with both strategies and projects that would help deliver the greenhouse gas reductions, you know. So a lot of time, money, effort, local jurisdictions have really participated in. You know, MTC is, and ABAG has established a lot of relationships in the region now, and so where we have a consensus on many of the things that we're doing. You know, what disturbed me was that when you're saying you're going to present a project to us, and if that project, you know, you'd think you'd ask for a priority list of projects from MTC, and if that project that is given to you, the first question you ought to ask is, why isn't it on the regional priority list? I mean, that to me would be the first question, because you very likely could be funding projects that are going to be counterproductive to our strategies and our Bay Plan area of actually achieving the greenhouse gas emissions, and deprive us of some resources to help accomplish our plan. And it seems to me that, you know, we just kind of squander the relationship that MTC and ABAG have built with the cities, the counties, the development community, you know, just the transit operators are finally getting them to look at land use and transportation. I mean, we've really, you know, if you look at what we've done in the last 5 years is making this connection between transportation, land use, greenhouse gas reduction, I think it's just absolutely tremendous. And it seems like that's just being put aside. And you know, so I just hope that there's a lot more consideration to the work that has been done in the region and the relationship that we built, because that's going to help deliver a lot of these projects. And, you know, I look at the TOA program that we have here. You know, what did we invest, $10 million? And what was the return on it? It was almost tenfold, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes.
I mean,
fivefold.
So we what an investment in transit-oriented affordable housing, you know. So MTC puts in $10 million, and we get a $50 million return. Those are the types of things we need to do. And it seems like, you know, it's like, well, we're gonna present these projects, and then we'll present them. You guys can evaluate them, but we're going to do what we want to do anyway. And it's just so inconsistent with all the work that we've done in this region. And we have – I just can't express to you enough – what an effort it was to build the consensus that we've built in this region. I mean, and hopefully other people will comment on this, but it just seems like we're squandering that advocacy that we built and support. And so, you know, I really hope that there is some thought about that relationship between the MPOs and as you develop your project, because you're going to have people just coming out of the woodwork with projects that I don't think is going to be consistent with what we're doing in the area or to help us accomplish our greenhouse gas.
Maybe to follow up on that question, so if a project applicant shows consistency with the goals of the SCS that's planned for the region, will that be a more highly regarded project? Let's say, for example, County X, City X has a project that's, again, maybe it's it's part of a PDA. It's in a disadvantaged community, you know, our priority development areas, and it's sort of consistent with the SES. Will that get a higher ranking potentially?
Very much so. It's actually very near a threshold criteria in all of our minds. Maybe I wasn't clear enough about let me back up just one step. And Jim, first of all, I really appreciate what went on down here. I'm from the Bay Area. I grew up in San Mateo. I follow the politics down here. And I have a sense of what you went through just from reading the papers. It was not always a bunch of people singing kumbaya around the campfire. So I know it was a difficult lift.
Well, the fact that you're here, I think, shows that you're considering our concerns. Yeah.
Then on the other side of the coin, there are a number of advocacy groups in the state of California, very powerful, have political interests that they would like to make sure are satisfied as well. And they wanted to have a process that was very open and that wasn't filtered through a public body. Mm-hmm. So we tried to craft the best of both worlds, being in a political setting, and that is this early screening process where we look at projects to see if they left out Section 4 of the application or not, or to see whether they have any chance of a greenhouse gas reduction at all or not, or whether the project applicant's not even on the eligible list. So that's all we look at in when they come into us. And then the very next thing we do is give them to you to tell us whether these are supportive of your goals or not. If they're not supportive of your goals, if they don't enhance your strategies, then we probably don't want them. You're going to pass them back to us and say, this one, and this one are really great. They get us where we're trying to go. These other five, forget about it. Well, that's going to weigh heavily on our decision process.
The concern I have is that the SGC, you're going to look at that project in isolation. You know, when we look at that project, we look at, you know, how does transit interface with this? You know, we take it's kind of the complete package. Yeah. You don't have that both knowledge, experience, and, you know, to understand who the local partners are. What commitment is the city going to make, the county? I mean, and the list goes on and on, where I think that we've developed those relationships and understanding it, which are very important to not only what we're accomplishing, but how it functions, you know, because it really needs to work in the long term, and it gives the benefits that we want. So I just wanted to express those. As I said, your opening comments, I was really encouraged, but then the further you went.
Well, let me try and ease your mind about this, too, because we're trying to address that in the sense that so we're at the point now where you're giving them back to us the concepts and saying, here's the ones we think really help us, here's the one that don't. In all likelihood, we're not inviting anybody that doesn't help you achieve your goals. Then we're scoring them, you're scoring them, and we're having a conference. And part of that conference is somebody from your staff is going to say to us, hey, you don't get it. This thing's connected to these four other things. And so that's what we're, you know, we're hoping to learn. This is a chance for everyone to try and get on the same page about the value of funding particular projects.
How are you going to provide technical assistance to those jurisdictions, especially many jurisdictions, disadvantaged communities, that in order to ensure that everyone has an equal opportunity to really have their proposal be considered? It sounds like it's going to be a lot of requirements. We haven't seen your guidelines yet, but it sounds like they're going to be, I don't want to say onerous, but there's going to be a fair amount of requirements. So how are you going to help out jurisdictions?
It will take me all day Sunday to get through them, I'll tell you that. we as happens with a lot of legislation, there's a great deal of expectation that we will help those communities, but there was not a whole lot of resource accompanying that. And what we would like to do, and I've proposed this to some of your staffs, and I want to propose it right here, is that we try and form partnerships where we can use my staff, our staff, the staff of the seven agencies, which is really great. It gives me a pool to draw from, a pretty deep bench of consultants, but that we can use that staff and your staff and together talk to the communities that you think have projects that really are worthy of moving forward, but these guys need help in crafting their proposal. And we'd like to do that with you.
Questions and comments? Mark. Mark, and then going back to Jake. You're wearing the wrong color today. I mean, is this... Is that... Oh, that's the morning color? That's the morning color, deep morning color in Scotland. Okay, I get it. All right. Okay. Mark, and then Jake.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. McQuay. I appreciate your candor and your presentation. Just getting a little more technical and more to the modeling side, I guess if the goal is to ask the obvious question, if the goal is to reduce GHG and by that reducing VMTs, is there a metric by which the arbiters are going to be able to say, well, in this sector, in the VMT world, that school transportation is reduced here greatly by this application, or telecommuting is reduced greatly by this application? I mean, is that going to be heavily weighted, or is that, or are there even metrics that allow anybody to judge that?
No, thanks for that question, Mark. It is a complicated issue, and again, I go back to this conference committee where we're going to end up talking about those things. The literature on these on available strategies has a wide range of answers, as you all know, but there is, at least with regards to some things like density and distance and accessibility, they're beginning to settle down to some normative numbers about the elasticities for these different strategies. And so I think as we move through this first round, that's what we're going to have to do. At the project level, we don't have great modeling tools at the project level. You have to run that big onerous model over there at MTC to get an answer about a big region so that you can try and then say, how does that apply to this little project? And that helps. It helps to get it in the context. But we still need to know what kind of trip generation, what kind of VMT is going to come out of those efforts. And there I would look to your modelers and our modelers to take their knowledge of the literature and look for the superior project.
Jake?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always a pleasure to see Mr. McCoy. I knew him back in his days in the academia, the halls of academia at UC Davis, and I've enjoyed...
You were a student of his, right?
No, actually, I was bringing money to UC Davis, which he was happy to receive from US EPA. I guess I will reflect upon what Jim Sperring said, and to say that when you look at the legislative history of SB 375 and what we around this table are all involved with, and certainly we in MTC and ABAG are charged with, and that is, you know, putting into effect the sustainable planning efforts with the targets that ARB has approved, and bringing together our regional transportation plan and working on our regional housing needs assessment numbers and trying to bring that into a place where we then reduce greenhouse gas emissions according to that ARB-approved target, then it seems to me that when we are sitting as equal partners with you and your colleagues, I'm assuming, by the way, that that would be in the Bay Area, that would be both ABAG and MTC. It wouldn't just be Ezra sitting at the table. Heminger or Alex or, you know, we would both be there, but it seems to me that in the legislative history of 375, where there was not given to us an enforcement stick, there was given to us the promise of money. And so here's part of that promise. Here's the cap and trade dollars. And it just seems to me that we, as your equal partners, would have to insist, and I think I'm picking up, Jim, on what you were saying, and that is that, you know, these are not intangibles we're talking about sitting around this table or when we meet as the Joint Administrative Committee of ABAG and the Planning Committee of MTC. These are tangibles, and these are things that we now, as I understand it, as a matter of law, are required to implement, working with the cities and the counties, working with the congestion management agencies to make these things happen. So I think I'm like Jim. Happy to hear your opening remarks as you get into the weeds, and as a weed scientist, I'm entitled to say that. As you get into the weeds of this matter, then one would start to become a wee bit worried. So let me just join myself with sparing and reflect a concern. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Jake.
Ezra, I think you had your hand up, yes, or your sign.
Yes, again, thank you so much for coming and trying to explain this. And I think what you're trying to accomplish is avoid application chaos, and you're coming up with this strategy where you seem to assign ABAG this role that we can coach project submittals, and then we can make recommendations on project submittals. That's what I think you were saying.
That's a correct interpretation.
Yeah, and I think you're also trying to satisfy the political or the politics of the NGOs that have sway in Sacramento, and you're trying to satisfy a lot of different entities, and that's going to fall back on, I think, the whole application process, because it's open to everybody, and then it has to get filtered through these entities, which creates, you know, this bias in the system that's going to have, you know, blowback that I thought you were trying to avoid. So I'm not sure you're there, and I appreciate the step, but I think that what Mr. Sperring and Mr. McKenzie are saying is that the structure that we put together to create the SES is the defining discipline of how things should be measured. And to avoid chaos, it should follow the structure. And therefore, that role of coaching and recommending may have to be transformed into something that's a little bit more powerful, so that we are ensured that we have some efficiency in the process. So that's number one. Number two is, I appreciate that you have all these different statutory guidelines. But the big test for this program is the lawsuit that's going to be initiated by the fossil fuel industry. And we know it's coming on the expenditure plan, which is going to test the California Constitution on nexus, so that there's a definition between what's a mitigation fee and what's a tax. If it's a tax, it fails. Now, this set of guidelines needs to be within the structure of the applications. It's a very important discipline that makes it really difficult for us to explain. It really needs to be explained by the state so that there's an overarching legal component that would affect how project applications are put together or how they're recommended. And it seems to be missing. I mean, I know we make reference to it, we state it, but it's a lot more complicated than that. And I was hoping that at some point there would be a group of attorneys that would be meeting with the boards and taking control over these guidelines and establishing the disciplines that are going to be required for these applications. And then we are better off fulfilling the role that you are assigning to us, which is basically to screen the Bay Area applications, which is a very difficult role, by the way, with 100 cities and 27 transit agencies, et cetera, without having this discipline clearly articulated as to what we have to provide to have a successful application.
I understand that problem. It's I think This is not the first time I've seen this happen with legislation that that the governing body is not ready or is not prepared, doesn't have the staff or the expertise or the data or whatever it happens to be. I always remember when 375 came out, none of us had modeling that was sufficient to meet the needs of that, and all had to scramble. And I think we're in that scramble mode again. ARB was given authorization to hire staff to work on this problem so that that catches up with us as we move through this process into January, February, March, and we're told we will get more guidance as we move along. It is a little frightening to be relying on my own judgment or the judgment of just a couple of lawyers at ARB and OPR. I would like to have a very definitive guideline for that. I don't yet have it. I do believe that by the time we're reading applications, we will have it.
I want to get back to this point that this is not the right the only pot of money of cap and trade revenue that that can flow to regions to help implement what's in our SES. There's a lot of money for low carbon transit, low carbon transportation, and so I know MTC is working on and looking closely at being eligible for those as well. I don't know, Alex, if you want to talk about how this effort can coordinate with maybe other efforts at MTC. Would follow to sort of bring cap and trade revenue into the Bay Area to implement various strategies in the SES.
Okay. First of all, I just also wanted to echo and thank Mike for coming today. And also, as he mentioned, he has been working very closely along with the other state agencies with some representatives from the MPOs. And I think we have made a lot of progress in trying to figure out how to sort of really partner and sort of leverage expertise both at the state level and sort of at the MPO level. So I wanted to acknowledge that. So you're right that the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities pot is a really important part of the cap and trade revenue. I think many of you know MTC had actually adopted a framework, a policy before the legislation went into effect for cap and trade, where we had kind of envisioned that we could have some additional money going into One Bay Area grant type projects. And so we really look at the Affordable Housing Sustainable Communities pot as something that we hope to really be able to advance those types of projects sort of broader, because now housing is eligible, which is great. We had also envisioned really being able to invest in some of our core transit projects like expanding the light rail fleet for Muni, expanding the bus fleet for AC Transit, looking at train control and expanding rail cars for BART, all of which are really needed if we're going to be putting all of these people in housing right around our, you know, right around these core transit facilities. So we think that those projects will probably align fairly well with the capital transit program that will be run by the California State Transit, CalSTA. We haven't seen those guidelines yet, but we think that the projects, at least that initially our commission thought, you know, would work well for reducing GHG, you know, we hope that they will align well with the guidelines that come out there. In terms of the low carbon operating program, which is actually eligible for operating or capital, but it's called the operating program. We think that that also can just help to, probably will help on the operation side, being able to ride, to provide expanded transit service, which was another thing that the MTC sort of framework that we put together before legislation envisioned. So we're definitely watching those very carefully. We haven't seen guidelines yet. They're expected in the next few months. So.
Right. Damien, do you have any, on behalf of the Air District, any sort of comment about this and other revenue sources in terms of what the Air District would be looking at?
Well, I think our main focus remains on the co-benefits and the major generation sector for greenhouse gas in our transportation fleet, which is heavy-duty freight and our transit strategy. So we're working with MTC on looking at you know, the different types of vehicle-type projects that we could do to reduce emissions from transit. We're obviously very interested in transit-oriented development and pilot projects to provide clean transportation, complete streets in those areas. Another big focus for us is zero-emission vehicles, light-duty and heavy-duty. So the all of these funds kind of play in and around the areas, all of those areas. So we are working to see how best our overall emissions reduction strategy fits into those. We would expect that a lot of the $200 million that have been set aside for low-carbon transportation would play into the vehicle space. And then pots like we've just talked about this morning, how we integrate that with those vehicles is an area where we're partnering with our MPOs and with state agencies.
Other comments, questions? Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCoy, thank you very much for coming. I'm still trying to wrap my arms around this whole process and the way it's going to go. So, first of all, I apologize for being late. And if you covered something I'm about to ask you, just blow me off and we'll talk later or something. But, I'm trying to get my arms around this thing because, well, there's a lot of money involved. And I'm trying to figure out how much. Now, first of all, the Strategic Growth Council supposedly is the one that has the final say in this whole thing, correct?
Yes, that's okay. Right.
That's good. And this will bubble up from us. We will submit projects, as I'm understanding it.
You did miss a bit.
Okay, so good.
So a key point, Scott, is apparently he said at the outset that the MPOs, so meaning MTC and ABAG themselves, can't submit, but would help in the screening.
I heard that. Let me tell you my concern. And my concern is the legislature and the governor. And I know you work for the governor, so I know you need to be somewhat careful. But I'm trying to figure out how much meddling. I don't trust the legislature, okay? And the minute they get elected from being a mayor or a county supervisor or something, they totally forget where they came from. And what I'm wondering is, once it gets up to the state level, how much funny money sliding around, three-card Monty, whatever, is going to be happening? Or will the Strategic Growth Council really remain an independent body that, you know, works with the MPOs to make sure that the best projects are getting done?
We and this is a responsibility I take extremely seriously. We're subject to the Bagley-Keene Act, which requires open meetings, and I do not allow members to have discussions about projects or projects approvals or guidelines in a quorum prior to any work that we do. It's public, and I would strictly adhere to that throughout this process. The legislature has afforded these funds to the administration. We are now administering them. At least for the moment, the legislature is not in that picture. They will come into that picture again next year when they consider, no doubt. I mean, it's all great to have a continuing appropriation, but it's only continuing as long as it's not discontinued. So, you know, we really hope that that process goes well, because when you think about this, and you're right, it is a large sum of money, but think about it over 10 years, and it's a really large sum of money. Right. And so if we could keep this program going for a while, instead of talking about 20 great projects that we will do next year, we're going to be talking about 200 that we're going to do over the next decade, and then you really start to see the impact on California's landscape.
Yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned anyways, you know, being a local elected official and watching projects bubble up from cities or counties, and usually they get to their CMAs, and then from there they kind of bubble up into MTC. There's a lot of public participation that comes along with that all the way. And my fear is, once we do all that work, and then all of a sudden the state decides, no, we'd rather do this, and we kind of needed, you know, the money over here to kind of get this project done, I'm concerned that there's not, I guess I'm concerned there's going to be a level of cohesiveness that's going to be lost. And I really hope that as the Strategic Growth Council moves forward, that they do tend to listen heavily on the MPOs because, you know, they're the ones that kind of went through the public participation, even in reverse, all the way back to the cities.
Let me say just one thing to that reassures me. I've only been there 2 years, but during that time, we have awarded $90 million to California cities and counties through strategic planning grants. And there have been over 100 such grants made, and the council has not reversed staff recommendations once.
Looks like you got them under control. So far.
Anything else, Scott?
Oh, that's good. Thank you. Thank you.
David?
I do feel a little better. Thank
yeah.
you.
David?
Thank you very much, and appreciate you being here as well. And I just wanted to follow up on that because as I was listening earlier, understanding that the Strategic Growth Council has the ultimate say or the authority, and I wonder, so conference committee, when there's an unequal power-sharing agreement, I'm not sure how that works. And I also understand there's two ways for projects to really filter up or bubble up. One is to come and be coached and recommended through the local organizations, like through ABAG. And certainly we appreciate you recognizing the scars that we all have through this last couple of years. But then you also mentioned those strong statewide interests. So what I wrote down was, you know, you got special interest groups that want to basically bypass a more public process and go straight to the top. Yeah. And I'm worried, and you mentioned the 200 projects over the next decade. How many of those are actually going to be through the local organizations? Are we just going to be throwing a bone and scramble over the leftovers yeah. while Sacramento is doling out the larger dollars projects to those who didn't come through the process like the rest of the local jurisdictions?
I don't want to be flippant about this, but the answer is 100% are going to be seen by you. The way we have structured this is we are partners in review of every project, not just projects that are submitted by agencies in your jurisdiction, but every project. And I think the other thing, and John knows this, is that only public agencies are eligible. So we're not going to see a special interest group forwarding a project of theirs unless they have some public buy-in for that project.
So every project funded will have consensus of both on the conference committee?
Projects are going to have to be supported by a public body, by a vote of a public body. So that's a threshold criteria. Nothing, if we come to that very first screening phase and somebody says, but our city council hasn't said yes yet, then they go in the other pile for come back later when you have that. So every project that comes forward is going to have a public body and a public process that's been associated with it. We will seek concurrence in that center, in that place where we come together. We may or may not get it. We both, I think, want to retain a measure of independence. I'm fairly confident that we'll achieve it, but you never know. And if we don't, we have a second chance to reconcile after you've gone to your board, because going through your board, we will then take the project list that came through there and have a second chance to say, well, did we really miss something? Because now here's this project again, which we disagreed on back then. Did we make a mistake? What are we doing? What did we hear between then and now? Is it something else? So I continue to be confident that we're going to reach a high degree of unanimity.
So maybe to follow up on that, so a public agency is the applicant, correct? And so they're going to receive the money. They could potentially partner with non-governmental agencies, but it sounds like the applicant has to be a public agency. So that would be a special district, city, county, or possibly one of the other regional agencies, excluding MTC, ABAG, right? Or BCDC is a state, so BCDC, are they eligible?
No.
And you don't know if the Air District's eligible at this point?
That's an outstanding question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? First, let me say, Mike, we really appreciate you coming. I mean, spending your time, and I think it's a testament that you and the Strategic Growth Council members are listening to the regions about how best to have this money be meaningful. And let me say, I heard from several legislators during the cap-and-trade budget process that they wanted to have the legislature allocate the money to specific projects. And I think to the credit, ultimately, of the legislature and the governor, the process, that was not the process. It's going through a process where there will be submittals and an open, it's not just going to be done in the Capitol based on what legislators' priorities. So the hope is that, right, all these projects we can show are meaningful and accomplish the goals so that we don't have the legislature in future years saying we want to allocate the money to specific projects. So I think it's the burden's on all of us to make this successful working with you. And I think what you're hearing from folks around this table and others is everyone here spent a lot of time, reaching consensus on our SCS, which, you know, we're very proud of the SCS from our region. We think it's very progressive at achieving, very aggressive goals on greenhouse gas reduction. Folks here went to dozens and dozens of community meetings, listening to the public, listening to CBOs, and there was a lot of compromise. And so I think everyone feels that they put out a lot of sweat to get to this point and want to, and feel that there's some ownership of that process and to have you recognize the good work that was done here.
I guarantee that I respect that. Public officials and their willingness to sit hour after hour in hearings, seeing what constituencies think and believe, and trying to incorporate as many views as you can and while responsibly protecting values, environmental values, economic values, equity values, is a daunting task, and I always admire those that are willing to take it up. And I thank you for having me here today, and I'd be glad to come and answer questions again on some other.
We'll sure have you back, I'm sure, right? Thank you very much. Thank you. All right, with that, we will move. Let's quickly approve the minutes before we lose our quorum. Is there a motion to approve item 2? Motion second. All in favor? Aye. Okay. Item 6, Resilient Shoreline Initiative, JPC project update. Oops.
Allison? Great. Thank you, Chair Joya. So I'm going to introduce Lindy Lowe and Matt Gerhart, who are going to present on the Resilient Shorelines Initiative. And I'll just make a quick introduction to this project. We had the benefit in July of hearing about, from Lindy, actually, and Maggie from BCDC, hearing about the ART program, the Adapting to Rising Tides program, and then delving a little deeper into the Hayward work around the shoreline there. That was really an attempt to get their arms around with a stakeholder process around the vulnerabilities of that shoreline in Hayward. And the Adapting to Rising Tides program outlined a process by which these stakeholders can come together around an educational process to focus in on what those vulnerabilities are and then ultimately getting to a place of decision-making about addressing the impacts of sea level rise and climate adaptation issues. So I think today we're going to hear about the Resilient Shorelines Initiative, which is a partnership between BCDC, the California State Coastal Conservancy, and ABAG. And I think it demonstrates that we are now dealing with a whole host of issues that are 21st century issues with climate adaptation. And these three agencies have stepped in to fill what is essentially a void in leadership in stepping in and addressing this and beginning the process of a long-term initiative as a region to get our arms around this issue and ultimately arrive at a place where, as decision makers, you can make the decisions needed and necessary to be proactive and deal with climate adaptation issues. From my perspective, this has been new to me. I've been learning a lot since I've come into this role as a JPC director, learning all the agencies and organizations that are operating in the space around the bay, the
the coast, water management. There are a lot of agencies working in this, and I think, you know, there's I think it's laudable what these three agencies are doing in terms of stepping in and taking a leadership role. Larry, you look like you want to step in.
I just want to say that it has been a lot of fun for Ezra and me, and I know for Sam Shukat, to watch our three agencies and our staffs of our three agencies work together and try to figure out how to integrate a work plan on this, because I really think that's what the JPC really wants us to do, and I think it's what the JPC members expect us to do. And so as you listen to their presentation, I want you to listen very carefully for Lindy and Matt as they say, this is what we're going to do, this is what they're going to do, this is how we're going to coordinate it, this is how we're working together, this is how the product's going to be a result of us, not a result of them and them and them, because that's really what the point of this partnership is really all about.
Okay, so, you know, to that point, I think we're at a time where we need to break through some of our historical roles and step in, and I think that's the process that we're doing. I've had the pleasure of sitting at the table with Matt and Lindy and Wendy and Caitlin, who are the project team on this. And so I'll hand it over to you if you want to step in and take over, Lindy.
Thank you, Allison, and thank you, JPC Committee, and thank you, Larry, for that introduction. So what is the Resilient Shorelines Partnership? You've heard a little bit about what Larry said. You've heard a little bit about what Allison said. We did sit around, the executive directors, the deputy directors, the planning directors and staff, and determine what it was we wanted to work on. So here's a quick, you know, in an attempt to, in three bullets, describe what is somewhat complex. It's a collaborative effort led by the Association of Bay Area Governments, BCDC, and the California Coastal Conservancy, working to engage public, private, and nonprofit agencies and organizations to understand shoreline vulnerabilities in order to increase resilience. And we are seeking to meet the objectives of the Joint Policy Committee's 2012 vote to take leadership in developing a regional sea level rise approach for the Bay Area. The partnership seeks to assess the region's vulnerability to sea level rise and storm event flooding, understand the consequences of those vulnerabilities. If something floods, what might happen to the regional economy? What might happen to the people who live in the neighborhoods? Identify priorities and opportunities for the region and local jurisdictions to respond, and develop cross-jurisdictional solutions that will lead to policy planning and technical assistance, so local governments who want to take this work up on their own can come to us for technical assistance and help in either the vulnerability assessment process or the trying to find out what might get wet, implementation guidance, and the funding, which none of us have quite cracked yet. The goals and objectives that we developed, all three agencies together developed, are to identify how sea level rise storm events or a major earthquake will affect Bay Area shoreline communities, infrastructure, ecosystems, and economy. And it's important to recognize that we're looking at this from a multi-hazards perspective, but primarily flooding and earthquakes. We're going to do this by assessing regional flood management capacity limitations and interdependencies, identifying the areas and regional assets that are vulnerable to sea level rise, storm events, or a major earthquake, and to gain a better understanding of what happens if something gets flooded. We want to develop both local and regional approaches to reduce vulnerabilities and build resilience. We want to, while we're doing this, address the four frames of sustainability: society and equity, environment, economy, and governance. We want to, and this is a really important component of this work that we're doing together, is to avoid duplication, make efficient use of limited resources, increase coordination and collaboration, identify gaps and needs, and establish priorities. One of the things we found when we started working much more closely with the Association of Bay Area Governments Hazards Program is that when they do an assessment of a neighborhood or a community, they ask the same exact information of the local governments and the special districts as we do when we're doing a very similar assessment. And so rather than going to the public works agencies and departments twice to say, what do you know about your assets, it made a lot more sense for us to start coordinating that work. Developing a shared regional data functions and capabilities necessary to support interagency work across geographic scales. So whether you're at the local scale or the regional scale, to have some databases, some easy, accessible, reliable data that you can use at the regional and local scales, that's a big challenge for everybody right now. So that while we're doing this work based on facts. Inform updates to Plan Bay Area and other regional plans, potentially the Hazard Mitigation Plan, and projects to help shoreline communities and build resilience. And seek financing to support actions and strategies at the local and regional scales. And as we're doing all of this work, we're always keeping the financing in mind in terms of how will local governments be able to implement some of these things, how will the transportation districts be able to implement some of these resilience strategies. And so I think until we can really define the problem and identify some real solutions to the problems, it'll be harder for us to make the case for money. So. And then I am going to turn it over to Matt Gerhardt, who is going to walk you through some of the things we've already done so far, that we've done so far, as well as some of the early, very early findings.
Thanks, Lindy. Good morning, everyone. And first, I'll just say it's a pleasure to be a relative newcomer to a JPC forum, working with the Coastal Conservancy as a partner. We are trying to establish partnerships like this up and down the coast currently. And are working in the LA region up in Humboldt Bay, and so we very much see this as an important, if not the most important, sort of leading edge for sea level rise planning for the state, and really believe in regional solutions to tackling the problems. Just to kind of get into a little bit of the detail, we've been meeting as a group of executive directors and staff for over a year with the Conservancy's participation, and getting to the place you see in terms of goals and objectives. We've taken a very careful look at all the activity that's going on in the region. And if any of you are involved in sea level rise planning right now, you know there's efforts upon efforts upon efforts. And so just the activity of understanding what's happening and tracking it has been a major endeavor for all of our agencies independently, and we're trying to centralize that and do a better job of understanding each other's participation in all of these things. We've been taking this high-level review here at sort of what do we internally already have sitting in our laps, and I'll describe a sort of more extensive version of that we're doing and some results. And we've been focusing on a near-term work plan, which is currently a six-month plan that's looking at the next 2 years of activity. Thanks. I'll just ask you to do that. Sure. Right now, the near-term, that six-month plan, looks at reviewing and summarizing the existing information, again, that we currently have in-house, focusing on the efforts that the agencies ourselves are either leading or lead partners in, trying to get sort of a consistent regional message. So there's some sub-regional work that's been done that applies to the region, and there's some broad-level regional work that needs to get synthesized. And not to get into the lingo too much, but diving into the consequences of these vulnerabilities is really the next stage. There's been a fair amount of assessment of what might happen, but there's still a long way to go in terms of understanding what does that mean in terms of the effects to a particular place or during a particular event. So a couple of these, and I'll kind of read through these. These are pretty interesting in a sense because they really do apply to the region as a whole. Essentially, what's standing out is the complexity of our shoreline. It may not be surprising to you if you know a piece of the shoreline, but when you add it up to the 100-plus jurisdictions plus the private and other public agency owners of the shoreline, it gets very daunting. This is going to be one of the hardest tasks for this group to understand, is how can we effectively manage the shoreline as in a coordinated fashion. We've also been, it's clear that certain assets stand out as the ones that present the sort of overarching challenge, so transportation and utilities being among those. They both have great impact, and they tend to be linear, which is just a problem because they cut across a lot of different areas and have to be dealt with comprehensively. Some of these areas are being captured in sort of what we currently think about as flood risk areas. So, and FEMA is in the process of updating their flood risk maps, which has caused a lot of scrutiny to this issue. But others are not. Others are sort of new ways of thinking about flooding, and we have to highlight those issues for communities. And finally here, you know, some of these things are actively protected by a FEMA or a Corps, you know, approved levy, but the vast majority are not, and people don't even necessarily know that they are a flood manager. They just have a restaurant by the shoreline, or they are a community service district or a school who happens to have some riprap. And it's definitely going to be a mindset change to move people forward there. So a couple things that we've actually created. We're working on an inventory of these entities, and that's the flood districts. But it's, and I wish I had the number on the top of my head. I think it's between 130 and 150 entities that we've identified to date. I'd say the majority of them are not, who manage shoreline assets, the majority of them are not flood managers. They're going to be other types of entities that are participants in your cities and counties and we're going to need significant assistance in this regard. And I will mention that just on that note, though, we are partnering with the Bay Area Flood Protection Agencies Association, which does coordinate the different entities, and there are some partnerships developing sort of alongside them to specifically coordinate the flood districts around their sea level rise strategy. We're participating in that. We've done some compilation of sort of the regional data that you will see out there. I'm sure you've seen the maps. So all the different agencies have their maps of in blue what gets wet by when. But this is an example of some information that we can create, and we hope to create in a better level of detail about how will it play out over time. So translating it from the eventual sort of threat that we've all become aware of to what will the story look like over time and who gets hit when worst. And you can see that the story from this just very brief look, the story's not going to be the same for every county. It's going to vary from place to place. It gets gradually worse for everyone, but you can see there that I believe that's Solano. You can see that it jumps up in certain regards for different places as they get to certain sea level rise. And this actually, I'll give Ezra the credit for this. This really comes from a fundamental question of how long do we have? And where do we have how long? And that is really going to be a driving question moving forward. Next slide. Another thing that BCDC has really provided a lead in is finding the right questions to ask. And Lindy mentioned not going out to people too much or with too much redundancy. And another layer to that is when you do go ask, make sure you're asking for exactly the right information in a way they understand and in a way they can actually give it to you. So there's been great work put into, this is a little snapshot of some templates for assessment that will be going on when we don't understand the vulnerability of a place. We can go get some of the key answers that we need. And then finally, I'll just end with right now what we're working on is this synthesis of these existing reports and studies that the different agencies have been focused on, and we're hoping to draft that this fall and have something early next year for sort of public presentation of the findings to date. And I think we just have contact info. But I do want to acknowledge Caitlin Sweeney, who's here with AVAG and is also a key partner.
Great. Thank you, both of you, for coming. And it's great to have you here, Matt. So hopefully you'll be here for future presentations. This is an ongoing work. There will be other, as we get more information, we'll bring that back to this, to the JPC for review. Was there any questions?
Any questions, comments? All right. With that was our last agenda item. So let's go through here. Are there other committee comments? Then we'll go to public comment. Any committee comments? I have one speaker card, Ken Bukowski.
Thank you. Hello, my pleasure to be here and record this. Just to let folks know that the recordings are now regional-video.com. You'll see an index of all the meetings and the recordings. Thank you.
Thank you. And our Allison, why don't you say a few words about it, Allison, rather than filter through me?
Well, November is the organizational planning, so Gina Bartlett will come to this meeting in November, and it will be an opportunity to have a conversation about the JPC, how it can continue to be the most effective body to serve the region, and how we can improve it. So, and the role of all of you, and the role of myself, and the partnership with the agency. So I do hope you can come, and I think it will be important to have your input. So thanks so much.
We are adjourned to November 21st.